I want you to think along with me about what's so nice about being at the Feast of Tabernacles. There are probably 1,000 people in here, and I got a hunch that the majority of you would come up with an answer pretty close to what I'm going to propose. Traveling up here yesterday in this beautiful part of the country, I mean, this is, you know, right next to Texas, this is it. Isn't this pretty country? Oh, my. Certainly does fit all the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles with the fall harvest. You see this beautiful spray and beautiful collection of pumpkins and all the beautiful things here, the flowers and the corn shucks and all that. Can't help but think about what's going on out in the agricultural regions of this country. So I can appreciate that. But you know what I really look forward to? Driving down the highway, coming here, realizing there might be a little bit of a crowded problem. It was seeing all of you. That's what makes this so special. It's the celebration of God's people being together. Oh, we could all stay home. Any one of us could have stayed home, but for some curious reason, you chose not to. You've gotten up, packed, you're good. Some of you had to change directions, and you had to come this way, but you're here. Being with God's people is very, very important, and at the core of why we get together at the Feast of Tabernacles. A thought crossed my mind, though, about some of you. Some of you might feel just a little bit lonely today because you're at a strange place. And it's never easy to be in a place where no one, no man, knows your name. And there may be some people here who have not met anybody yet, and so as of yet, you are unknown. And that's just a little bit uncomfortable. And I hope that changes by the time the Feast of Tabernacles is over, and that there'll be just a host of renewed friendships, brand new acquaintances, as well as the opportunity to carry home with you names and addresses that you will have for the remainder of your life. Good friends coming about as a result of the church. But I would like to share with you someone today that I hope you will identify with, because I think this individual has an important future. Few of us will ever know what it's like to not be known or to have a name like John Doe, number 24. John Doe, number 24. His story was recorded in the Associated Press, and it goes something like this. Quote, this was on his tombstone. Unknown since 45, John Doe takes his secret to the grave, Jacksonville, Illinois. I don't know if that's very far away from here or not. The mystery of John Doe, number 24, outlives him, however. There were very few clues, because he was blind. And he was a teenager, just wandering around the streets. So the authorities picked him up. They detained him for a while. No relatives could be found to claim him. They couldn't communicate with him. He couldn't talk. He couldn't hear. He was just there. So he was placed in an institution, John Doe, number 24. Number 24, because he was the 24th person to be placed in an institution without a name. He lived in the health system in the mental ward for nigh on to 45 or 50 years or so. No one really knows exactly how old he was when he died, but he was up in his 60s. Once he had died, there were some interviews made regarding who he was and where'd he come from, and nobody really seemed to know in all those years. But one of the attendants, whose name was Kim Cornwall, who was a caseworker, talked about him just a little bit and said, you know, there had to be quite a bit of a story there. He had a few quirks and a few mannerisms that carried a little bit of who he was wherever he went. They talked about the fact that about the only name that he could scrawl out or even verbalize was the name Lewis. However poorly he would scrawl that out, it would just be the name Lewis. Then they said that every once in a while, he would begin to act like he was marching. Like he was marching in a band somewhere. Made people wonder about, well, how come he did that? He would pantomime very poorly being in a jazz bar. Now, I'm not sure I know what that means. I'm just telling you the way the story was told to me here. I don't know whether he was tapping his hands or whether he was gyrating or just what he was doing, but there was, for some reason, they thought it was something to do with a jazz band. This lady, Kim Cornwell, said it was so obvious from what he pantomimed that he had had quite a life at one time. She said he must have been a lot like my grandfather, because he could have probably told us a lot of funny stories, but you know, she said, we just couldn't find a way to get it out of him. Well, he had a straw hat he loved to wear. And along with that, he took a backpack as he was up in years, and in this backpack, he carried all of his special possessions. He carried his rings, carried his glasses, and he carried some silverware wherever he went. That's all he had when he died. At a brief graveside service on a Wednesday evening in Jacksonville, a woman who was there asked if anyone had any words to say. No one had a word to say. Not one person. No one. I want us to think about John Doe, number 24, because you see, somewhere in the darkness of who he was, there is a story. A life. There was a name. It wasn't John Doe, number 24. There was a name. He was named at some time. I'd like you to go behind those eyes that couldn't see and see into the past as only he could, although he couldn't verbalize it and he couldn't articulate it. But there was a young boy who at one time had been held by his mother, surely. There was a son who at one time had been carried by his father. But all we can do is wonder, what did those sightless eyes have to see that he couldn't get out? Could he reflect back and remember being a young child, a young kid with a cane pole on a muddy river? Possibly. Was he a wide-eyed youngster eating popcorn at a circus? Had he ever played in a jazz band in New Orleans? No one will ever know. No one will ever know, because he could never tell. He couldn't even speak his name. On the day he died, no one had a word to say. What do you say when you bury a life no one knew? What do you say? Solomon seems to address this a little bit for us. If you'll turn to the book of Ecclesiastes with me, we're going to notice a few verses as we go along. If you were to take the book of Ecclesiastes and start reading right now, you could read it in about 40 minutes. That's about how long it takes. If you're a slow reader, it might take 45. We're not going to read every verse today. We don't have that kind of time. But I might ask you to do that, because the book of Ecclesiastes answers the questions about John Doe, number 24. It also tells us a lot about ourselves and about our lives. Now, have any of you ever had trouble with your children? Anybody over here ever had trouble with your children? One lady raised her hand and then her child pulled it down. No, she didn't have a child there. All right, how many of you have had trouble with your children? Let's be honest. All right, now, good. Okay, now I know I'm talking to a converted audience. Believe this or not, I have had trouble with my children. Does that come as a surprise? I hope it doesn't. Years before having children, I remember as a ministerial trainee, I was visiting with a minister, and the minister had a son, and he was telling me about how he was rearing his son, and I listened with attentive ears. And his son was going through a little bit of a troublesome time with his father, and his father told me about what he was telling him, and I listened. Now, this is what he said. I'm paraphrasing, because this is many years ago. The young man was in trouble. I'm not exactly sure what he wanted. I don't know whether it was a car. I don't know whether it was money. I don't know whether it was something to do with girls. It could have been one of those or all of the above. But the minister told me that in the dialogue with his son, this is what he said. He looked at his son and he said, "Now listen, I want to tell you something." See, this is a parent gesture. "I want to tell you something. There's not a thought you've ever thought that I've not thought. And there's not a deed that you've never wanted to do or done that I haven't already done.
So don't you think for 1 minute that I don't know what you're thinking. Have any of you ever used that? Now, I have to confess, I use this. I remember several years ago when my oldest daughter was 14, I think about 13 or 14, we went through a little set to in our life, and I remember I thought I'm going to use that speech. So I got my oldest daughter in the bedroom there, and I was going to give her down the road. Well, she was listening attentively, and I looked at her and I said, "Now, I want to tell you something. I don't know exactly what you want to do, and I don't know exactly why you're doing it, but I'm going to tell you something. There's not a thing that you're thinking that I haven't ever thought. And there's not a thing you want to do that I haven't wanted to do or already done. So whatever it is, you quit it." And I thought I gave a great speech. I walked out of there, and she walked back to her bedroom, and I thought, this was one of the greatest speeches I've ever given. And I got to thinking about it afterwards, how foolish that must have sounded to my daughter. And she probably went back to her bedroom and just snickered. Now, have any of you ever used that line of reasoning? The writer of the book of Ecclesiastes uses this a little bit, and I want to introduce you to a phrase. It's a little bit of a modern update of what he says. One of the frequent expressions that Solomon uses is, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Have you ever read that in there? Time and time again. You know what he meant by that? He meant, been there, done that. I've been there and I've done that. I mean, the one who started this speech originally was Solomon, because he said, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. I've been there and I've done that." Do you believe that? I've been there and I've done that. I want you to see some of the things that he says here. It's rather fascinating. Beginning in verse 1, he says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, been there, done that. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, everything is vanity." And then he gets to talking about why he came to that conclusion in the verses that follow. Now, here's a man who could have anything. I mean, he could have anything. He had anything and everything he wanted. I might ask of you if I could take a survey of hands, which I'm not going to do. What do you really want in life? If it were our young people, they might say, "Well, I'd like to have, depends upon their age, a new car. Or a car." They all want new cars. But we don't give them new cars because they wreck them. See, young people don't think they wreck them. But we parents who pay the insurance, I'll tell you, they wreck them. I was talking to a gentleman just yesterday, and I mean, I'm going to build up a list of people that I can call on for support in this. Because my oldest daughter, Tanya, is probably one of the best drivers in the world. She'd been driving for about a month. Guess what she did? Guess what she did? Yeah. Been there, done that. See, she's going to be able to talk to her children one of these days like I talked to her. Yeah, she had a little bumper, a little scraper. You know, that she said that a car hit her. And it wasn't serious, and I'm grateful for that. Very grateful. And if that wasn't enough, my stepdaughter, she had an accident too, right in my driveway with my vehicle. Now check this out. She got in the vehicle and backed up, not realizing there was a vehicle behind her. So those young people who are out there and you're wondering, "Well, why don't mom and dad get me a new car?" It's because you wrecked them. No one will convince me differently at this point. I've been there and I've done that. Say, don't tell me you're going to be different. I want to believe that, but will you be? He goes on to say here, as we come over to chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, "I said in mine heart, go to now, and I will prove you with mirth." That's with pleasure. And as I was talking to you a while ago, I said, well, if you could have anything, what would you want to have? Some young people, a car, maybe it's clothes. But let's come to us adults. What kind of things do we want? A new home? Do you want to have a new home? strange thing's been going on in my life as I get a little bit older. When I was younger, I wanted a big house. Now that I'm older, guess what I want? I want a boat. Not a real tiny one. A pretty good sized boat. Just at anchor because there's no grass to mow. Right? I won't need a car that breaks down regularly. It'd just be a real simple lifestyle. At least that's what I think. Yet I know better because the minute I got down there, a hurricane or something would come along and I'd be in big trouble. Oh, all is vanity. Everywhere's vanity. It's the same old story, isn't it? We get into one-upsmanship. We'll talk to people and we'll say, well, have you ever been to, where's the great place we'd all like to go, besides Tyler? I'd like to go to Monterey, California. All right, how many of you would like to go to Monterey, California? Can I see your hands? I've been there and I've done that. See, let me just take it from me. I've been there and I've done that. Okay. By the way, you do want to go there. It's a nice place. How many of you want to go to Florida? Not a hand. Not one hand is up. Oh, there's one back here. We could go. Well, this is what we do. We engage in these conversations with the people. We'll say, well, where do you want to go? Where are you going on vacation? And then we'll say inevitably, well, I've been there. I've been there and I've done that. Right. And so we've been to one place. Guess where we want to go now? Going to the one place, does that satisfy you? You've gone to one place. Now you want to go to someplace else. You go to that place. You want to go to someplace else. You go there. You want to go someplace else. Isn't that the way it is? That's the way it is. All is vanity. Been there, done that. How about something as simple as eating? Some of us would say, well, what's the nicest meal that you could ever have? Depending on where you come from, that could vary. Where I grew up with a kid, ham hock and beans was top of the line stuff. Okay. But then I learned about other things with big names like Chateaubriand, with all the assorted vegetables and the goods and the meat cooked carefully, and that's the reason why I had a heart problem. But you know what? Once I had that Chateaubriand, you know what? Do you think that's all I wanted? Do you think I wanted to try something else? No, you try that. You got to try something else. You got to try something else. You got to try something else. Because once you've been there and done that, you got to have more. Isn't that the way it works? It tends to work that way, doesn't it? Same thing with clothes. Same thing with accommodations. I was thinking about here at the Feast of Tabernacles. In comparison to the way many of us started the feast many years ago. You remember that? A lot of us started out in tents. How many of you have tented at the Feast of Tabernacles? I see your hands. Okay, the rest of you are wise people. I did my share of the tenting as well. But you know, once you've tented, guess what you want to do? You want to stay home. No. You want to stay in a motel, don't you? That's what you want to do. Then you stay in a motel. Then guess what you want to do? You want to stay in a condo, don't you? And down in Florida, in Panama City Beach, I was surprised to learn that, guess what? Once you've been in the condo, guess what you want to stay in? The penthouse. See? I tried to get it once. And members from Chicago already had it. But no, it starts out tent. Then it goes to motel room. Then you want to go to condo. Then you want to go to penthouse. I don't know what there is after that, do you? A boat. Mr. Widmer says heaven. Do you see my point? I mean, hey, let's be honest with ourselves. This is how we tend to work. Because what's at work here is a law of diminishing return. A law of diminishing return. I know that I fall victim to that. I see that Ecclesiastes addresses that. Do you know what I mean by the law of diminishing return? It means that you expend X amount of energy to do something. And expending that energy brings back a response from you. Some enjoyment, some pleasure. And you like it. I might even use the word rush. Do you know what I mean by a rush? By the way, I don't take drugs. I don't mean that in that light. But apparently it's a high point. It really, you know, it gives you a rush, I say. Now, But once you've done that, the law of diminishing returns says that the next time you do it, you want to have that same feeling. So you know what you do? You keep working at it. You keep working at it. You keep working at it. It becomes your passion. This happens in lots of ways. I'll use myself as an example, and maybe it'll help you relate to it. I remember years and years and years ago now, about 20 plus years ago, I got interested in a sport. I know I'm talking to some of the men in this audience now, some of you here, some of the ladies too. I wanted to take up racquetball. Any of you ever played up racquetball? Okay, I took up racquetball. And I remember the very first I went out there, I didn't know a thing about racquetball. Not a thing. I mean, I knew a little bit about the racket and the ball and what to do. And I went out there, and we got to batting this ball around, and we worked up a good sweat. And I came out of there, and I thought, this is incredible. I really love this game. This is wonderful. Now, I went back the second time and the third time, and I'm getting better, and I have to keep getting better to get that same feeling, that same pleasure, that same satisfaction. Because if I played like I did the first time after I'd been playing for 3 months, I didn't get the same satisfaction. And yet I was expending more energy. Because I got better, and I got better, and I got better, and I really got to where I was fairly good at it. At least that's what I think. I played racquetball, and I played racquetball. And finally got to the point to where people would come into the racquetball court, and this is how they'd come. Whereas when I first started, it was just funsies. It didn't make any difference who won or lost. You just play the racquetball, get out there. So here I am, I'm putting more energy into it, and I'm getting better, and I'm getting better, and guess what's happening? I'm still getting the rush because I'm getting better and I'm winning, but I'm expending more energy and more energy and more energy, and I'm getting better and better. And meanwhile, I came to a point where I enjoyed it a whole lot less. I finally got to the point with racquetball where I quit playing because I didn't enjoy it anymore. It wasn't fun because I couldn't get that feeling back. I think there's a song back like that somewhere, isn't there? I just couldn't get the feeling. It was no fun. People would come in, they get themselves psyched up in racquetball. Have you ever seen this on TV? They do it in racquetball as well on TV. They come in. You think I'm exaggerating? That's what really pushed me over the edge one time. I was in this room, and I came up with this guy to shake his hand and say, well, I hope we have a nice match. And I thought, good night. I just wanted to have a nice game of racquetball. And so we'd get up there, and we'd serve this ball, and we'd do all this kind of thing. And I would say to him, when he would score a point on me, I'd say, well, that was a good shot. I'd compliment him. Now, when I would score a point, guess what he would do? He could not tell me that I had shot a good shot, and he just was not going to do it. And so I determined then I was going to quit racquetball, and I did. I said, it's not any fun anymore. Now, I use this as an example because I've done this in golf, too. I was never a great golfer, but I got the same amount of putting all this energy into it. The law of diminishing return comes to play. And all of a sudden, I got to a point, and I said, well, this isn't fun anymore. I'm not going anywhere with this. This is called living under the sun. This is an expression that Solomon uses 29 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. If you ever read the book, you might want to underline those. This expression, he's living under the sun. That's what it's called. I found out that when I was living under the sun, there was a law of diminishing return at work. And finally, I couldn't expend enough energy to get that feeling. I recall one day I was playing racquetball and I had done some exhibition tournament play. I played for about 3 hours in a row. I was exhausted and I actually got faint and fell against the wall because I had become disoriented. I put that much energy into it. It wasn't fun anymore. It just wasn't fun. The law of diminishing return. Ecclesiastes talks about it time and time and time again. Solomon experienced it, and he wrote about it. Now, if you'll read with me about some of the things that he got involved in, I suggest to you that these are the things that we get involved in, too. These are things that eat up our time. Notice what they are. He said, I sought in mine heart to give myself into wine. This is over in verse 3. Yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly till I might see what was that good for the Son of Man, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life, There was one he said is he got right on the edge of things. Oh, yeah, he even took a little bit of wine. I'm not saying he was inebriated and drunk, but he got right up to where it was close.
See?
And he said, look, I made me great works. I builded me houses, he says. I planted my vineyards. I was out to our homestead the other day, and I remember years ago when my grandmother was there, she had a big, beautiful garden. I walked by there, and it's tended to by my father now, and there's no garden. That's gone now. I guess it's probably too much work. You get to a certain age where it's too much work. He says, I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them all of all kinds of fruit. These are things that we all do. He says, I made me pools of water to water therewith the wood that brings forth trees, planting orchards. I even have a little fountain in the front of my home. Someone gave it to me as a wedding gift. I have a nice, beautiful fountain there. You know, little waterfall. I like waterfalls. It's broken now. It doesn't work any longer. All is vanity. It won't work forever. I decided in my boat I'm not going to have a fountain. This all is vanity. He says, I made me pools of waters, I read in verse 6, to water therewith the wood that brings forth trees. I got me servants. See, there's the solution. I got me servants and maidens and had servants born in my home. So, how about that solution? Having more than one wife. What do you think, men? Some of the men are going, No, that's not it. And yet, you know, we can't convince ourselves of that in this society. In modern day America, we can't convince male men, not those that deliver the mail, but male men, that one wife is the ticket. See? People think today that having an affair is where it's at. No. If you want to make your life miserable, just try it. See? That's not the solution. The law of diminishing return. How many wives and concubines did Solomon end up with? More than enough. It wasn't a matter of just one or two or 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50. It was a matter of 100 and 200 and 300 and 400,000 plus women in his life. Can you imagine that? The best way for you women to identify with that is to think, imagine having 1,000 men like your husband in your life. Have you ladies ever thought about that? Just imagine having 1,000 men like your husband in your life. Peter becomes an alternative then. No, Peter does not. Just think about that. All these... Solomon tried it. The law of diminishing return. Got to have this one. And I realize a lot of those were political marriages. I understand that. But got to have this one. Got to have this one. Got to have this one. Well, that's not enough. Let's have this brown-eyed one. Let's have this red-headed one. Let's have this blonde-headed one over here. Let's have this 6'6" one over here. Let's have this 2'3" one over here. Let's have them all. See? And all of a sudden, he comes to, later on in his life, guess what he came to? Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. And what he tells all of us in this audience, I've been there and I've done that. Been there, done that. All right. Let's read on a little bit farther. He goes on to say that, I gather me also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings and other provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sounds of men as musical instruments and that of all sorts. So guess what he comes to in verse 9? So I was great and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. All my wisdom remained with me. And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my portion. My labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hand had wrought and on the labor that I had labored to do. And behold, all was vanity and vexation of the spirit. And there was no profit under the sun. He had been there, and he had done that, and he learned that living under the sun
was not the solution. And I support that. Living under the sun, though we have to do it. If that's what motivates you, living under the sun, as he worded it, it takes you nowhere because it's totally selfish. It's what you get. It's how many wives you have. It's how big your house is. It's how many cars you drive. By the way, I'm not against people having things. I don't mean to imply that. But if that's what you live for, then you've got a problem. Because Solomon said it doesn't take you anywhere. It's frustrating. It's vexation of the spirit. I want more. I want more. I want more. There's no end of it. So what we have to do is what's called a paradigm shift. We have to change this just a little bit. And we have to change from living under the sun to living above the sun. You know what I mean by that? Turn to the book of Colossians with me. In Colossians, chapter 3. And this is what we're given an opportunity to do every single day of our lives, every moment, and certainly at the Feast of Tabernacles, that we can choose to live life from above, not from below. Notice what it says in Colossians chapter 3, in verse 1. If you be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sits on the right hand of God, and set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. That's pretty simple, isn't it? It couldn't be any more simple than that. You set your affection, your sight, on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth. Sometimes we think that credentials and degrees and money and prestige and wealth and the clothes with the little insignias, not that any of these things are wrong, I'm not applying it. That's it. Well, I want to do a little survey with you. I want you to take a little test with me. If that's where it's at, I want to see how you answer these questions. If it's in education, if it's in credentials, and if it's in, you know, the number of books you read, and if it's in all of that, then I think that you'll do well on this first test. Now, here it is. It's very simple. Name for me 5 Nobel Prize winners. Well, nobody's got their head down writing. I don't know. Okay. Name for me then, that was a tough one. Name for me 5 Pulitzer Prize winners. Well, okay. Now this one may be a little bit easier for you. Name for me the last 5 movies that were best pictures. Well, we're not making any progress here. All right, how about this one? If money is where it's at, as they say, then I want you to name for me the 5 wealthiest men in the world. 5 wealthiest men in the world. We're not interested in that, are we? I know one, because he's been on TV, Mr. Gates, you know, the guy who's ruined my computer. Mr. Gates. All right, now let's see if you do better on this, because this tells us the difference between living under the sun, where you get involved with things like that, versus living above the sun. Do this for me. First of all, I want you to name 5 people who really stood by you when you needed help. Just think about who they might be. 5 people. Any of you think of anybody? Oh, I see some activity here. All right, so this is working. All right, well, how about this then? Can you name 5 teachers who influenced your life? 5 teachers who influenced your life. See, nodding. Okay, heads are nodding. Lastly, I want you to name 5 friends who believe in you and would shed real tears if something tragic happened in your life. 5 people. Are you doing better? You know why you are? Because that's what counts in this world. It's not credentials. It's not wealth. It's not buildings. It's not cars. It's people who care. That's what counts. I think that, if I may be just personal with all of you, I have a large group of you here, Especially that third one I asked you. There was a time in January 5th, which I'll always remember, where, as I was telling some of the Houston brethren the other day, when some unexpected things occur in your life, and some of us have some unexpected things going to happen to you. It happened to me. I'm only 47, so I'm not all that old. Not all that young anymore either, come to think of it. I'm just 47. Next thing I knew, I was in a hospital, and one thing led to another thing. And next thing I know, I wake up, I'm terribly uncomfortable. I mean, I couldn't tell you how uncomfortable, except other men and women in this room who have gone through it. I just wanted to raise up out of the bed, and Betsy was there with me, and I told her, I said, oh, please raise me up. I didn't know what had happened, and I raised up, and I looked down on my chest, and what they do is they staple your chest together. I had about 32 staples down the center of my chest. I looked down there, and I thought, oh, my. What has happened to me? What has happened to me? But what's more sobering in all of that is realizing how important God's people's prayers are. And if you don't believe that, you are mistaken. God's people's prayers are very, very important. You see, there was a time when I was on that machine, and I was, for all intents and purposes, I was dead. Because they unhook you in here, you know, and they take your lungs and they deflate your lungs and they put you on a lung machine. So you're in the hands of a machine. And then they take your heart, which is still beating, and they hook you up to a heart machine that keeps that beating. You're disconnected. And I don't remember any of it, but when I came out of it, all I remember was blackness, darkness. I don't remember anything. I do remember waking up, and my sweet wife was there beside me, very concerned about me. And I was moved to consider what happened when I could not pray. Because I could not pray. But I want to thank you all for praying. Thank you for saving my life. The person next door to us died. Right next door, right next to where Charles Gross was, Betsy was talking to another school teacher. Right next door, a gentleman who entered in just like I did, didn't come out. And he is now awaiting the resurrection. So thank you. I just wanted to put that in there. Thank you very much. If any of you are sick and need healing, you trust this body of believers here because they have the power to move God to save your life. And some of us needed that. That's living above the sun. Because you folks weren't concerned for yourselves, you were concerned for somebody that a lot of you don't even know. It was just a name, an unusual name at that. Gross. So here I am to pester you again, the Feast of Tabernacles, and I'm so grateful for that. I am really grateful to be here and to be well, about 90%. I'm not 100% yet. You don't squeeze me too hard, the slingy might come out or something like that as I tease, you know, because they wire you together. I don't know if you know that. You're wired together in here. You're just wired together. I'll never look at a slinky quite the same. It hadn't been too long that I was out of the hospital, and a lady of some strength, who was she genuinely was glad that I was alive. She came up and she thrust herself on me in a bear hug, and I thought that slinky was playing a song in there. Ding, 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 ding. But I'm okay now, and I like being hugged. What, did you get the point? You know what's really important about living is to live from above, not from below. We've got to see things as God sees things. And to do that, we've got to know that we care about other people. I'd like to give you a couple of examples to illustrate that, if I may, because this is an important time of the year, the Feast of Tabernacles, to practice this viewing from above, giving attention to others rather than yourself, It could be done in prayer. It could be done in deed. Whatever way you want to do it, just do it. Practice living above a little while. Let me tell you about a poor mountain girl who was brought into a hospital by a minister. This poor mountain girl was born with her bladder outside of her body. Her mother, when they were brought into the hospital, her mother and her seven-month-old brother were brought in with her into the hospital. And they stayed with her day and night. Now, this young lady, this mountain girl, I get the opinion she's almost, 10, 11, maybe 12-ish in through there. Not the age is not given, but somewhere in through there. She had always lived back in the back hill country. Any of you ever live in the back hill country in this part of Kentucky, Tennessee? I raise my hand. I've lived back in the hill country. Yeah, okay, so we know what it's like back there. Well, this girl lived way back there, 10 miles from anything. And because of her handicap, she didn't really get out. She had never seen a car. And I think this article that was written about her was about 1994, if I recall correctly. So it's current. She had never seen a car. One time she saw a truck. And she sort of peered at the truck, and she giggled over it because she watched the people in it. It was an old rickety road, and they were bouncing up and down. And she just giggled. She said, well, I don't want to ride in that because it'd make me jiggle. Just would jiggle me to death. But here she was. She was brought into the hospital. She had this bladder problem. And a newspaper reporter got wind of the story and reported it. And it caught the attention of a number of people, not the least of which was a conductor on a train. And he extended an invitation to the family to take a ride with him on his commuter train. And there happened to be two of them, and this is down in the state of Georgia where the story takes place. And after accepting the invitation, they were brought and put aboard the train. They're riding along, and it's a little bit uncomfortable for this young lady, this back hills country girl. But there was something that happened there that would forever leave a lesson on the mind of the reporter who told the story. They served lunch. And have you ever ridden on Amtrak on trains of days gone by? They served on white tablecloths or, checker tablecloths. And she was a little bit distanced by that because she, she had never been served on a white tablecloth before. But she looked at that, and that was all right. Because, as a matter of fact, it's no big deal, is it, that there are white tablecloths and silver dishes, things that she had never experienced. Now, this is what happened. When the waiter came over there and brought the bowl of soup to her and set it down, she looked at it uneasily. She wasn't quite sure how to tackle it. So, before anybody could show her what to do, guess what she did? She just picked that bowl up and drank it down. Think about that for a moment. The waiter was a little bit amused by all of this, and he was starting to work up a pretty good smile until the official who had done the invitation, or extended the invitation to the family, looked at him, and by glaring at him, let him know that he ought not to make anything out of this at all. And the official then took up his bowl, and guess what he did? He drank it like she did, and the reporter remembers looking around at the rest of the diner patrons, and guess what they did? They all picked up their bowls, and they drank like she drank it. There's a pretty important lesson in this, isn't it? Because if you live under the sun, what do? You snicker, you laugh, you point your finger, you make fun of them, because we know how kids do that all the time. And yet adults do it too, don't they? I'm really concerned in this country of ours about the way in which some of our less fortunate are viewed. Those that are put out of their homes, or those that have been left without anything. And the homeless. I know that a lot of homeless are just running a scam. I'm not talking about those. But I'm talking about the other people. Because we say, well, looky there. Now, I know most of us in this audience, I know how we look at it. We look at it and say, there go I, except be the grace of God. That's how most of us in this room would look at it. But when you live under the sun, you don't look at it that way. But when you live above the sun, you look at it the way in which these people looked at it. Because it is right to want to do it the correct way. But there was something more important in this particular instance by making the young mountain girl feel comfortable and at home. That's living above. One other example I'd like to give to you, which I know our children are going to appreciate. This is a story about Susan Duran. Susan Duran has a daughter named Stephanie. Stephanie's in high school. She's about 16 years old. Typical family. One day, Stephanie's not feeling well. And her mother, Stephanie asks her mother to say, "Mom, if you don't mind, phone the school, let them know that I'm not feeling well, I'm not going to be there." The school had a rule. Guess what the rule was? The rule is, if you don't report by 2:30, it's held against you. Well, the mother called in late. She didn't make the deadline. So her daughter got a notice, Stephanie got a notice from the school that she was going to have to serve 2 days detention. 2 days worth. Guess what the response of the mother was? She says, "You're not going to treat my kid that way. You're not going to punish her. Because whose mistake was it?" It was the mother's. The daughter reminded her of that, by the way. So you know what the mother decided to do? And this is what I call living above the sun, because it's the exception to the rule. The mother went to the school and talked to the authorities there and explained the situation. She said, "It was my fault. My daughter was sick. I was the one who should have called. And if this is all about responsibility, I've got to be responsible. I'm going to go in her place." A 34-year-old mother, a businesswoman, did just that. She went to school in the place of her daughter. She sat in a little bitty desk. She had to sit there from 8 to 3. She couldn't even get up and go to the bathroom unless she asked permission. What do you think her daughter thought of all this? She did it for 2 days. I love what her daughter had to say. Her daughter said, "You know, in my lifetime, my mother has done some pretty neat stuff, but nothing like this." What do you think about that? It's just a different way of doing things. Today, a lot of parents would just say, "Give it to them." That's what that car wrecker needs. Put him in detention. Now, this woman found another way. Now, listen to me for a moment, because I think that this is absolutely true. I believe that the Feast of Tabernacles can be a defining moment for all of us in this room. It can be defining. It really can. Because we're going to have to all pitch together here. We're all crowded up. Some of you are already unhappy. Okay. Because of parking, or because you're too crowded, or because you're over there in the other building. There's all sorts of problems. People are going to leave their books on these tables and these chairs here, and you're not going to like that. Don't go and don't sweep them off on the floor. That's living under the sun. I want you to live above the sun. I want you to view things from above. We're going to have a lot of cooperation here as we get adjusted through the feast, right? It can be a defining moment for you, because there's going to be times ahead when you're going to have the character and the determination and the vision to see yourself through. Because what's ahead of us is not all that pleasant. And what we're going to face here is going to be hardly just a drop in the bucket. But, you know, Solomon talked about a lot of things here, and this vanity and vanities, all is vanity. Let's come back to the book of Ecclesiastes, if you will. And I want you to see something he talked about over in chapter 7 and verse 1. Now, this is over halfway through the book of Ecclesiastes. And Solomon has worked his way through a lot of things. But one thing, if you want to read these verses up to this chapter, you're going to be convinced that all is vanity, and I've been there and I've done that. And you're going to need the exhortation that I'm providing for you to live, view things from above, not under the sun. Now we come to something that's interesting in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, over in verse 1. It says here, "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death, the day of one's birth." That's an interesting verse, isn't it? In other words, he gives you a good and a better. A good name is better than precious ointment. And what they did back then, they wore perfumes pretty much like we do. And a lot of people thought, okay, being perfumed and having all the things together and smelling right and all that's worth that. But Solomon says, no, a good name is better than that. And the day of death better than the day of one's birth. Why would he say that? The reason why is between birth and death, you make your name. It's just that simple. Between birth and death, you make your name. Well, we have a name. The church has a name. And all of you have a name. It's a good name. But it takes me back to wonder about a fellow who had no name. John Doe, number 24. No name. And yet, wasn't there a story there? Wasn't there a full life there? A man who lived under the sun? Yeah, there really is quite a story, and it's in a great degree it involves you and me, and a lesson out of the Feast of Tabernacles, because we're called upon here, each one of you. I could go right down this row and point at every single one of you. This is about Jesus Christ tabernacling inside of you during the Feast of Tabernacles. It's not about him tabernacling in me, I hope he is, but he's tabernacling in all of you, and you, and you, and you. And we could go right down this row. We could come over here and we could come over here. Isn't that what the Feast of Tabernacles is all about? Christ tabernacling in you, and when he does, you don't see it under the sun. You see it from God's viewpoint above the sun. And I guess he's going to come back here one of these days from above the sun. Jesus Christ is going to come back here. Oh, and when he does, it's going to be incredible what he does. He's going to descend to the Mount of Olives, as all of you heard on the Feast of Trumpets. Rather miraculous things are going to take place. I want you to see that, if you just remember this thought back in Ecclesiastes 7 about this good name. I want you to turn back to the book of Revelation, to the events that are briefly talked about here. Because I want to try to pick up part of the role for you and for me in the kingdom of God. It says in Revelation chapter 20, picking up in verse 4, following the events where Satan the devil is bound up and thrown into outer darkness, and he is gone. Thank God. Finally. I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them. Judgment is given unto you and to me. And I need judgment. I need to know how to work with 14-year-old daughters and 16-year-old daughters and my neighbor and people in the church. We need wisdom and direction and judgment. So judgment then in this day and age, that time, will be given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands, and they lived and they reigned with Christ 1,000 years. What a wonderful time that's going to be. Notice in verse 6, blessed and holy is he that has part in the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. That's what this is all about. That's what we're living through here. We're just getting started as we begin the wonderful Feast of Tabernacles. All right. What are you going to do for John Doe number 24? I want you to see something that you might do. It's back in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 30. And I realize that John Doe, number 24, is going to come up in the last great day. Unless he was converted, and I don't suspect that he was. But there's something to be learned here about this time period and all of us, and seeing things from above rather than from under the sun. It ties in, for example, with John Doe, number 24. Notice, if you will, pick it up with me over in verse 19. For the people shall dwell in Zion and Jerusalem, and you shall weep no more. He will be very gracious unto you at the voice of the cry, and when he shall hear it, he will answer you. And though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not your teachers be removed into a corner any more, but your eyes shall see your teachers, and your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk you in it, when you turn to the right hand and when you turn to the left. And the way I thought about that when I read through that is very simple.
As a spirit being, as a priest and the king working with people who need direction, you can come up to them and you can grab them by the ear. You can do whatever you want to. Don't hurt them. But you can do whatever you want to and just say, listen, I've been there and I've done that. Don't do that. Don't you be unfaithful. We've been there. We've done that. Don't you abuse your children. We've been there. We've done that. Don't you set your mind on money. I've been there. I've done that. You think a boat is the answer? See, in another 10 years, I'm going to give you the update to this. But I already know the answer. The boat is not the answer. I've been there and I've done that. There's only one thing that's the answer, and that's viewing things from above, caring about people, loving people, living like Jesus Christ would live in you if he were alive on this earth today. And he's tabernacling with all of us. This becomes important to me because of John Doe, chapter 24, number 24, excuse me. Because I try to imagine this. I try to project myself ahead a little bit to an incredible fulfillment of time. And I have a chance to live like that even right now. Here's the way I see it. And this all comes to me because of what I read in John's account about Lazarus. Because you see, I haven't been just totally complete in my story to you about John Doe number 24. It is not true that no one knew this man's name. God did. God does. And one day, one glorious day, he will hear his name called by the only voice that matters. Come out! Come out, John Doe number 24. Only thing he'll call his name. Tom, Peter, Andrew. Now, thought is one who's going to work with him afterwards. Man who's never heard, man who's never seen. Didn't Isaiah chapter 30 address that a little bit? Oh, there may be a flurry of activity to get to him. You and I may be in a foot race for him. And we'll get there, and he'll be going to the left. We say, no, you need to get to the right. He'll go to the right. He'll say, oh, no, you need to get over to the left. And you'll get a hold of him and just say, listen, believe me, I've been there and I've done that. And you will steer him on the better way of life for 1,000 years. Well, we have an incredible, incredible opportunity to learn the messages meant for us during the Feast of Tabernacles. It's so satisfying and so enriching, and it is so good. You have a name. I don't know your name. I hope to know more of you. I started by saying something which I think is very true. It's never easy to be in a place where no man knows your name. I hope by the end of this Feast of Tabernacles there will not be one person, not one man, not one woman whose name is not known by someone. Because unfortunately, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who await the fulfillment of this day for Jesus Christ of Nazareth with you at his right hand to stand there and to proclaim his name and say, all of you, come out and pronounce your name. And there you will tell them how to live life. And you will say, I have been there, I have done that. Believe me, there's a better way. We're going to live from above. We're going to stop living from below. If you live from below, it brings about the wrong results. So during this feast, let's all do each other a favor, will you? Let's live from above, not from below.